Coming up on Weekend America.
Voters are focused on the economy over the environment, healthcare, or energy. But if you live near the refineries in Houston, it's all one issue.
Yeah, sometimes when I wake up, I feel like my stomach hurts and my head's hurting because of the smell. So yeah, it's like really bad.
I'm John Moe. Also this hour, writing a scary story is tough, especially when it has to be no more than half a minute.
I don't go to scary movies. I'm easily scared by them. So I've actually avoided them my whole life. I don't go on roller coasters, all that sort of stuff. So I was trying to think of the things that seemed terrifying in daily life.
David Rakoff and other authors write 30-second tales of terror. And musician Ben Folds is on the road. He's not packing light.
So we have French horn, glockenspiel. We have triangles, shakers, tambourines. Synthesizers.
Also a grand piano and two keytars. It's Weekend America after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe, and I think I know exactly where your head is at this weekend. You're thinking about two things, the election and Halloween costumes. We have you covered. Throughout the show today, we're offering 30-second tales of terror, spooky stories by top writers in half a minute or less. We're going to get you in the mood for Halloween. Plus, how history will record the Obama candidacy, an adult film festival casts a chill on an engagement in Seattle, a garage full of fake body parts in Pasadena, and musician Ben Folds and his keytar. Keytar? Keytar. What are you doing this weekend?
I am going to hang out with my husband. Hopefully it's going to be nice weather. We'll take our last bike ride of the season.
I'm flying to lovely Las Vegas, Nevada.
Hopefully I'll be braising some pork belly.
Well, this week I'm house-sitting for my uncle, so this weekend I'll be hitting up his hot tub. Hopefully I won't add too much chlorine in the wash cycle like I did last time.
Always stacking wood, getting ready for the winter.
This weekend I'm going to a pre-Halloween party, and we're going to have scary named food, like rigaboni instead of rigatoni. And witch's fingers, which are Cheetos.
Ah, very clever. You know, Cheetos were originally made with actual witch's fingers. People don't know that. Those voices came from Ann Arbor, Michigan, St. Paul, and Concord, New Hampshire. Well, the economy continues to be the big story. Rough week on Wall Street. I'm getting kind of tired of saying that week after week here. The dominance of the financial crisis in the run-up to Election Day has meant that energy, the environment, and healthcare have been moved off the front pages. But for people in Houston, home to many of our nation's oil refineries, those issues are always front and center. For the final installment of our series, Politics on the Spot, we head to the industrial heart of Houston, the Ship Channel. Houston has no zoning codes, which means anything can be built next to an oil refinery or chemical plant. Weekend America's Michael May was surprised by what you can find right behind Refinery Row.
One day I was driving over the huge Fred Hartman Bridge, suspended over the Houston Ship Channel. The view was so breathtaking, I had to pull over to the shoulder to get a better look. The Houston Ship Channel is an epic alien landscape. Miles of smoldering oil refineries and chemical plants extend all the way to the horizon. I could have stood there and counted smokestacks for hours. What I couldn't see was all the tiny homes tucked into this industrial labyrinth. And down there, next to three chemical plants, is Cesar Chavez High School.
And what do you see coming to this school that you don't see in other schools?
Juan Paras is talking with a group of students at Chavez High.
I don't know, they dumped some kind of chemical waste, and like all the fishes were dead and they were floating in the water.
It stinks.
Yeah, sometimes when I wake up, I feel like my stomach hurts and my head's hurting because of the smell. It's like really bad.
As someone who lives near here, Juan Paras understands. He runs a small environmental nonprofit called Tejas. He tried to stop the school from being built here 8 years ago. The nearest plant to the school is Texas Petrochemicals, which produces a volatile chemical called butadiene, used in rubber tires. Butadiene is also known to cause cancer. There are three large plants near the school, all emitting toxic chemicals.
I was repulsed. I was like, wow, I can't believe they would put a whole bunch of teenagers in an area like that.
17-year-old Carolina Medina lives several miles away from the plants, but takes the bus here each morning. From the school grounds, it's hard to see through all the thick, leafy trees. But just beyond the football field, you can see the tall flare where Texas Petrochemicals burns its waste. Sometimes the flare illuminates the field like Friday night lights.
I hope none of these plants explode because that means I'm dead.
A Texas state law discourages industry from building within 3,000 feet of a school. But there's nothing to stop the reverse from happening. So the Houston Independent School District found cheap land here and built the school. Juan tells the kids the neighborhood is an environmental dumping ground.
And why? Because one is we don't vote. They say we don't vote. And the other one is because we don't have the money to fight the companies. So the only way we're going to accomplish a lot of stuff is by getting together, doing demonstrations like a lot of us did when we were doing the immigration marches, where literally hundreds and thousands of people got together. That's what you need.
As an activist, that's what Juan needs. But what he's got is a different story. Most presidents here don't seem to care, even with mounting evidence that people along the channel are getting sick and dying from the fumes. People here have more pressing worries, like Carolina. Her mom is supporting the family alone on minimum wage.
She can't afford everything. Sometimes it's hard for her to pay the bills, but somehow she always manages to come through. You know, you only live once, and you can't always be worried about bills. You know, you need to have fun, and it's hard for us to do that. We don't really get to go out as a family because we don't have money.
The kids in this classroom are directly affected by many of the policies debated in this election. But of the dozen or so 18-year-olds here, only two plan to vote, and both are undecided. We leave the school and turn down a small side street. Juan starts knocking on doors of houses backed right up to the chemical plants. He's gathering support for a class action lawsuit to make the plants clean up their emissions. We find Luciano Barón working in his enormous backyard. He just bought the land 2 months ago.
Right now, after the hurricane, all these trees fell. I can see everything there. And I said, wow, I don't know, all these plants are behind us.
Luciano runs a landscaping company and needed enough space to park his trucks. He found the best deal right here.
We think we have lucky, but I don't know. I don't know if that's lucky or not, but we are here, try to live with it.
Right now, Luciano's family lives across town, but he wants to fix up the large home on the property.
Probably I come back to live in here, but I'm gonna see. If there's something, any problems, I don't want to bring my kids in here. No way.
If you bring your family here, you're just gonna have to realize that you're gonna be breathing that chemical day in and day out.
Juan's soft-spoken persistence seems to be paying off. At the end of the day, we stop at the home of one of the young volunteers that Juan has recruited, 27-year-old Jesus Macias. We're invited in for pozole, a traditional Mexican stew.
Try that other stuff. That's homemade, too.
After dinner, they turn on the final presidential debate.
4 years ago, when I was 8 years old, he engaged in despicable acts with a radical domestic group. I have roundly condemned those
Jesus
acts.
Has just become a citizen. And will be voting for the first time for Obama. But as the debate goes on, he seems disappointed.
No, there was nothing for us, not for our community, just a few things about clean coal technology, but no things about the chemical plants that are actually in our communities now. The ones that are here are not clean, they're dirty. So gotta work on the ones that are actually here in our communities.
But Jesus isn't holding his breath. He's got a college education and a good job. He plans to move far away from here as soon as he can.
He has never been involved in this campaign.
In Houston, I'm Michael May for Weekend America.
So that's Mr. Ayers. Now, with respect to Acorn...
We contacted Texas Petrochemicals, the plant directly behind Chavez High School. In 2005, they signed an agreement to cut their emissions of butadiene by 50%. At the time, they were releasing 104,000 pounds a year. According to a spokesperson, Texas Petrochemicals has met all their emissions targets and has made the plant safer overall. Well, I'm sure people in Houston will be thinking about all of this as Election Day nears. As America gets ready to vote, it's easy to see this contest as being not about issues, but as a battle between Democrats and Republicans. However, an increasing number of voters are defining themselves as independent. John P. Avlon is the author of Independent Nation and a fellow at the Manhattan Institute. John Avlon, welcome to Weekend America.
Great to be with you.
What defines an independent?
Independents tend to be fiscally conservative and socially progressive. They're folks who have declared independence from the two-party system because it doesn't represent them. They're sort of saying that the far left and the far right are equally insane and out of touch. And we've had a huge growth in the number of independents as a result.
What do you see politically from the two major candidates as the election approaches, how they're playing to those independent voters and what they're trying to do?
Obama's whole primary stump speech was so directed at independent voters. I mean, his whole discussion was about how we had to change our politics to fix the broken, divided politics in Washington and break through the red state, blue state divides that have held us back. And then I think as his nomination fight against Hillary Clinton got tougher, then you started seeing him pivot to more old Democrat themes. But you just look at the fact that he's proposing a tax cut plan. Well, that's very unusual for an old school Democrat. John McCain represents an outright revolution against the far right of the Republican Party. They've always hated this guy because of his principled independence in the Senate. But I think he's been surrounded in this campaign by so many folks who are of the Bush-Cheney-Rove era, who only know how to run play-to-the-base campaigns. It's really hurt his brand and his credibility on this front.
And to follow that logic, the selection of Sarah Palin would hurt him among independents.
And it has. Sarah Palin has proven to be a deeply polarizing figure in American politics. You know, you excite the base at the expense of uniting the center. But that gamble hasn't paid off in terms of independents and undecideds.
Where do undecideds fit in among independents? What's the difference? What's the overlap?
Well, undecideds are really just a function of an election cycle, right? If there are any professional, consistent undecideds out there, they should probably seek help. But if you look at the actual numbers, Wall Street Journal, NBC had a poll the other day that showed that 43% of undecideds were independents and 47% were centrists, showing the overlap there. But compared to 2004, a lot of independents felt they were choosing for the candidate they disliked least. And Obama and McCain had very high approval ratings for independents all throughout the summer. McCain had a brief bump, and then the economy kicked in. As this election became a referendum on the Bush administration, and moderates in the middle class started feeling squeezed by the economic crisis, they swung heavily towards Obama, and they've stayed there today. I think it's going to be incumbent upon Obama, if he wins, to really keep faith with those voters, who are many of whom were given voice by Colin Powell.
Was that a Republican becoming a Democrat, or was that an independent behaving as an independent?
You know, Colin Powell's been forced to play politics by Washington rules, but he's got an enormous amount of credibility with independents, really moral authority, because he's been independent. The reality is that Washington has this corrosive conformity that tries to force people into what David Brooks has called teamism, my team versus your team, us against them. And it's so disconnected with the way most folks want our political leaders to act. And when someone crosses party lines from a position of principle, it reaffirms that.
John P. Avalon is the author of Independent Nation, How Centrists Can Change American Politics. He's a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. Mr. Avalon, thanks so much.
Thank you, sir. Take care.
Is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week. And Constant Contact, dedicated to the success of small businesses and nonprofits. You can learn about email marketing at constantcontact.com.
"32nd Tales of Terror," none of which involved the stock market. We didn't want to get that scary. Coming up on Week in America. Thank you.
It's Week in America. I'm John Moe. We know two things. First, it's the weekend, and you might be busy running errands. Second, Halloween is approaching, and you want to hear some spooky stories. All through the show today, we are going to bring you 30-second tales of terror, half a minute or less. Because honestly, who has time for the whole he walked down the hallway step by step thing? Come on, get to the point. We invited some of our favorite writers to present scary tales in half a minute. Our first comes from David Rakoff.
Henderson felt the needle go into his forearm, and almost immediately he tasted the drug on his tongue. And then he didn't care about anything. The cold metal gurney? A feather bed. The screaming fellow down the hall? Birdsong. Suddenly he couldn't wait to have his appendix out. The nurse smiled at him. Relax, she said as she fitted the rubber mask over his nose and mouth. You won't even remember the triple bypass by the time you wake up.
David Rakoff is a writer in New York City. His latest book is Don't Get Too Comfortable. More stories by David and others at weekendamerica.org. If the polls are accurate, Barack Obama will become the first African-American president in a few days. Obama's spoken carefully about race in this campaign. He's asked people to focus on unity. But while Obama has stayed on message, the 2008 campaign has been all over the place. Reverend Wright, Fox News calling Michelle Obama a baby mama, Bill Clinton dismissing Obama's South Carolina win, making a comparison to Jesse Jackson. Today, researchers are gathered at the University of Minnesota to ask what we can learn about race from this campaign. Weekend America's Desiree Cooper talked to the conference organizers, the University of Minnesota's Catherine Squires, and Joe Fagan of Texas A&M University.
Joe and Catherine, welcome.
Hi, Desiree.
Hi, Desiree.
Joe, I want to start with you. According to your research, we should be looking at the Obama candidacy through what you call the white racial frame. What exactly is the white racial frame?
That's a broad racial framing of society that we whites have developed over four centuries. Racist ideas, racial stereotypes, negative images of people of color, and it also has very positive images of whites in it. We whites are quite virtuous in the white racial frame. And what happens in the Dr. Wright case is that a negative story about a very outspoken black man who's talking about racism in the society resonates with that frame, which has in it an image of the dangerous black man.
So that might be why, for example, Sarah Palin's unwed teenage daughter, we can look at that with a little bit more sympathy than perhaps if that had happened in a black family or in Obama's family specifically, because it doesn't really match the frame that we have of what white society is like, but it does match our view of what black society is like?
Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah, but the fact remains that he has achieved something that no other African American has been able to achieve, and also something that so few people ever believed was possible, even up until January of 2008. Catherine, how did we get here?
I think the 18, 19, and 20-year-olds who are going to be voting this year, they grew up being taught that multiculturalism is good. I'm 36, and when I was growing up, there were so few children's shows, for example, that had cast members of color. My kids and the kids I babysat for when I was in college and grad school, they grew up with shows that have interracial couples as the parents of the children on the shows. So there's a completely different visual landscape. Their first presidential election, they had a Latino candidate, a black candidate, and a white female candidate. I'm not denying this white racial frame, but I do think something is happening when you see these legions of white college students who are, you know, giving so much energy and attention to the Obama campaign.
Yeah, I guess I would disagree to some degree with that analysis. I think the group that Catherine is talking about is a minority of college-educated white kids. We just had 626 white college students at 28 colleges and universities keep diaries for 6 to 10 weeks. And guess how many racist events these best-educated young whites gave us in these short diaries? 7,500 accounts of racist incidents, joking events, mostly with friends and relatives, mm-hmm. that they either engaged in or observed in their everyday lives. They were in the West Coast, all regions, 28 colleges and universities. We also had 308 students of color, and they record, in addition, 4,000 accounts of racist events that happen to them and their friends, like being called the N-word on the street or being beaten up because they were with a white girlfriend, racist joking that goes on in their presence when whites expect them to laugh along with the N-word joke.
Catherine, you were talking about how popular culture has all these images that are multicultural, and yet sometimes, you know, I cringe at what I see in popular culture. You know, I'm thinking of shows like I Love New York, some of the reality shows. Is that really opening up young people?
Well, I don't think I Love New York is opening up anybody's mind about anything. I hear, you know, of course, I do not have the sample and the spread of data that Dr. Fagan has by any means, but I also have observed my white students who say very similar things about television shows like Dave Chappelle. They want to laugh. He uses the N-word freely, as do very popular comedians like Chris Rock and others. And so there's a lot of confusion, I think, amongst black and white students and students of other racial backgrounds about what's funny about this racial humor. And I think a lot of us are wondering who's laughing at what aspect of this humor. You know, there is progress in some sectors of popular culture and there is throwback. But I do think from the students that I talk to and anecdotally, they're thinking about this differently than, say, their parents or their grandparents would.
Regardless of who's the next president, what would you be looking toward him to do to address a national conversation about race?
Well, I wouldn't have him do what Bill Clinton did, which was convene this panel and send them out into the wilderness with really no real mandate. I don't think that kind of quote-unquote national conversation can do much. I think this has to be a conversation that white Americans are invested in, and that's going to be a hard job.
Our population, even of our best educated whites, is highly illiterate on things like racial stereotyping, race in American history, astonishingly illiterate. What little education they get comes out of this mixed set of messages that Catherine is talking about in popular culture.
Joe and Catherine, good luck with the conference.
Thanks very much.
Thanks for inviting us.
For more about the research conducted by Catherine Squires and Joe Fagan, go to weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, KPCC Los Angeles, and KUOW Seattle, and is made possible in part by the University of Washington Foster School of Business Executive MBA program.
A garage full of body parts. No, it's nothing disturbing. Just a guy who collects fake body parts in his garage. I guess that is a little disturbing. Ahead on Weekend America. From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. In this last week and a half before the presidential election, we've got a lot on our minds, all of us. The economy, the World Series, Sarah Palin suits, you know, important stuff like that. Also chickens and pigs. Okay, maybe you're not thinking of livestock, but small farmers like Ethan Book of Iowa definitely are. For our series, Conversations with America, we went out to Ethan's farm to find out what a small-scale farmer is thinking about on the eve of the election.
We live about 6 miles south and west of Knoxville, Iowa. The common name for it around here is we live just off the crooked road to Melcher. Our name is Stonyfield Farm. I'm just a big history buff, and it's actually comes from President John Adams, and he loved to go back to his farm and just kind of retreat to it, whether it was putting up hay or dealing with the livestock. And he started out calling his farm Peacefield, but he was kind of a stoic, puritanical kind of guy, and so he started referring to the farm as Stonyfield. Now, these are pigs that we're growing for customers, and we sell them on halves or whole basis. A customer can get a half a pig, and so these pigs are just raised outside. They have access to grass, and then all the pig feed they can eat. This chicken got in the pig pen. I'm not sure if she knows how to get out, but I'm going to let her give her some time because it's muddy. You know, I'm not your conventional Iowa farmer in that, you know, we don't have a combine and we don't have 800 acres of corn and soybeans. We're raising food the way that your grandparents raised food. And so we don't feed any hormones or any antibiotics. We just let pigs be pigs and cows be cows. We'll take our hogs, you know, one at a time to the locker and to the processor, and then our customer will come and pick it up. Well, regulations for those small-town processors are becoming more and more difficult because it's all geared towards bigger. And so that leaves the smaller things behind, whether it's Main Street stores or small family farms. Being a small family farm means thinking differently these days, but I still think it's a very important part of our culture and economy because it's local. You know, we sell to our customers in, you know, that 30-mile, 40-mile radius and closer. We sell to our friends at church. It doesn't get much more local than that. Because of the way that farming is in Iowa and in the United States today, for somebody to come in and say, hey, I want to be a farmer, everybody kind of looks at that a little skeptical, or they say, oh, that's not possible. But it's also, you know, going to banks and saying, all right, we're looking for an agricultural loan, and we want to buy 40 acres, and we want to build a house. Well, it wasn't easy to find that. Come on. I work as a youth pastor at New Covenant Church in Knoxville. So we have income coming in, which is the only thing that makes farming possible for us. We saved for the first 7 years of our marriage to get to this point. And so it's kind of like we've been working so hard to get to this point, we're not going to let anything take out the fun of it. When I go to vote, there's just going to be a lot on my mind. You know, I'm no economist. I took economy in eighth grade, I think. But we need to be concerned about our local economies. Here in Iowa, because grain prices have been fairly high, we've been a little more insulated. But if we keep putting our focus on bigger is better, instead of allowing room for small farmers and small businesses, and then I think, you know, we're going to just keep slipping down that slope. It really needs to be a cultural shift. I see that chicken got out. I'm just glad she got out. I didn't have to chase her around the pig pen.
Ethan Book has a blog called The Beginning Farmer. He also writes about farming for Epicurious.com. Come see Ethan and his cattle at our website, and while you're there, join our conversation online. That's at WeekendAmerica.org. We'll be right back.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
It's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. Uh-oh. You know what that means. It's time for another 30-second tale of terror. This one from author Elise Primavera.
There are bad people out there. At least that's what the security guy system told me. You were by yourself at the end of a deserted road, he said. I can set your system so a beep sounds every time a door is opened. When he left, I went out to get the mail. Beep! I came back in. Beep! I cursed the security system. But hours later, I'm awakened. My heart is pounding. Alone, in the dark, I hear the sound of beep!
Elise Primavera is a children's book writer from Red Bank, New Jersey. Her credits include The Secret Order of the Gum Street Girls. We have more stories at weekendamerica.org. We continue our GarageLand series this week, a peek into that space intended to shelter our cars but so often used for art, inventions, terrible rock bands. Today, we head to the apartment jungles of South Pasadena, California, and meet Brad Palmer. During the week, Brad's a makeup artist. You might have seen his work on CSI New York or Heroes. On weekends, he's in the garage making props. What type of props? Well, let's just say there's a reason we're airing this story the week of Halloween. Here's reporter Klaus Andreasen.
It looks just like any other suburban back alley, with rows of neatly painted single-car garages. It's peaceful and quiet, unless you stop by Brad Palmer's open garage door. Blood stains on the floor and shelves of body parts, a severed arm here, a hacked-off leg there, and a couple of skulls sitting atop a bookcase. This is where Brad makes movie props, and as I walk in, he's just finished sawing off the end of a human leg made from silicone and foam. And now he's carving into it with a sharp chisel.
See, when you first cut your polyfoam, there's nothing really there. So what I need to do is dig into it, hollow it out a little bit, dress it up with some silicone, make it look kind of nasty. I got to put in the anatomy, like muscles and bone. And of course, the final dress comes through is when you slime it and bloody it up. And that's really what brings it to life.
He puts the leg aside and shows me another project he's working on for a friend's independent movie. On top of a square piece of green foam, he's put a layer of flesh-colored sheet foam and latex, and inside a slit in it, what looks like vertebrae. It's for a very violent fight scene, Brad explains, where a strong man knocks another guy down, reaches into his back, and rips his spine out.
And there's a pocket that holds the spine. Upon action, the actor reaches into the guy's back into his shirt, digging into this little canal area, and then he jerks the spine out free and holds it up for everyone to see, and the audience goes, ah, ooh, and oh, gross.
Brad looks very sweet and boyish, but obviously with a taste for the morbid and macabre. It took him a while to acquire that taste.
As a kid, I was really afraid of a lot of things. I was afraid of the dark. I was afraid of being alone. I was afraid of all kinds of things. And especially even horror movies scared the crap out of me. I mean, I remember seeing Poltergeist at my aunt's, and I couldn't sleep for a week. And then later on, I was with my older brother and some of his friends, and they were watching one of the later Friday the 13th movies, and they were all laughing at, like, all, you know, the kill sequences and all this stuff. And then it just kind of dawned on me, and I got it. I got the idea that this is a way to get that adrenaline rush and that face that little fear thing and laugh about it and enjoy it.
Daytime, as a professional makeup artist, Brad is often busy making healthy people look injured and dead. But it's here in his little shop of horrors his gory imagination roams even freer.
Do you ever make anything nice and sweet?
No. It's not my style. I do. I like that kind of stuff, but on occasion, but no. No, I like the gross stuff. I like the monsters and the gore.
In Los Angeles, I'm Klaus Andreasen for Weekend America.
You can check out Heads, Hands, Spines, and More. Oh, gosh, I'm looking at all these things. That's at weekendamerica.org. Okay, I want to alert parents and, well, I guess everybody out there that this next story deals with the subject of PORN. Adjust your radio dials and computer audio streams accordingly. Adult entertainment is the talk of the town in Seattle this weekend. Thousands are attending an amateur porn festival there. It's called Hump. But of course, it's a tricky subject. What some people find enjoyable or stimulating, other people find off-putting, uncomfortable, or gross. Reporter Liz Jones lives in Seattle, and she falls into that latter camp. Still, she has a connection with this film festival that was not of her choosing.
All my life, I've made a point to avoid watching porn, but recently it's been thrust upon me. My fiancé, Anthony, works for The Stranger, the news weekly that puts on Seattle's amateur porn festival. Anthony helps pick which films get in. Every October, Anthony excitedly gears up for a porn-watching party with his coworkers, and each time, I try to pretend like I don't care. This has been going on for 3 years. I figured it was time to confront the issue.
What, does that bother you, that I don't like porn?
Well, I don't think it's true. It would bother me if it were true.
What do you mean it's not true?
Well, I think, I don't know, I think you don't know that you like porn.
Do you think if I just gave porn a chance that I would like it?
Yeah, just give porn a chance.
I was raised in a strict Christian home, and certain ideas about good and evil have been hard to shake. The childhood me believes porn is evil, but I wondered if maybe Anthony was right. Maybe the adult me would see things differently if I just gave porn a chance. This year, Anthony's coworkers plan to screen the films at our house. This is an opportunity, I thought. An opportunity to see if I could actually come to like porn. Anthony and eight of his coworkers cram into our compact living room. They eat hot dogs and cookies, eyes fixed on the big screen TV. I quietly take a seat in the corner next to Anthony.
Oh, boy.
Oh. Wait, what?
I find myself mainly watching the group, partly because I'm squeamish about the action on screen, and partly just to see their reactions. Everyone's having a way better time than I am. Anthony gives me a comforting look, and I shrug back, trying to play it cool, but really, I'm feeling pretty grossed out. I sit through a few short films with names like Bored in Bellevue and the Ladies of, I can't say the other titles. I'm surprised to find a lot of these films are actually sort of funny. There's an animated short featuring a cop with an unconventional weapon, and another one where two zombies negotiate a romantic liaison using only awkward grunts and stiff gestures. I start laughing a little, but then a really bad one comes on. Bad, like naughty bad, and also just low-budget movie bad. It's exactly what I've come to expect from porn. Trashy movies with no plot. I put a fresh plate of wholesome veggies and hummus on the table and head upstairs. The next day, I'm shell-shocked. Dirty images bombard my brain, and I feel guilty. I decide to seek out some help.
Hi, Audrey.
Hi, nice to meet you.
Audrey McManus teaches classes about sex and porn and all things related. We meet at Toys in Babeland, a woman-friendly sex toy shop where she works. Apparently, a lot of women come to Audrey with porn issues.
You know, it's not for everyone. There's people who are completely opposed to it, who just think it shouldn't be allowed at all. There's people who are like, I love it, I love it, I love it.
What do you say to women when they come in with those concerns, like trying to get past some religious guilt?
I guess I would just sort of show them anatomy books and talk about pleasure-based anatomy and talk about stimulation and all that. And then I would say find porn that was made by women for women. You know, I would imagine you've seen some pretty crappy porn. And if you are interested in exploring more, I could recommend some titles.
Audrey gave me 3 rentals to take home and try. After 2 days, I returned them unwatched.
Is it okay if I don't like porn?
Yeah, it's totally fine. If you don't like it for yourself personally, I think that's fine.
A porn expert says it's okay if porn's just not my thing. I feel validated. But Anthony thinks I didn't give porn enough of a chance. And he's still convinced I secretly like it. His evidence is that one time at a hotel room in Sylvania, I didn't immediately turn it off.
Do you think I'm a prude?
No. I would imagine. You know, those childhood taboos are really difficult to overcome. And that's something that I've learned by knowing you. And because it's something that's not that familiar to me.
Is that maybe something that you like about me?
I guess it's a challenge. I like everything about you.
That's so sweet.
We'll be out of town during this weekend's porn festival, so luckily, the choice of whether to go is out of our hands. Lucky for me, anyway. For Anthony, well, maybe he'll get lucky next year. In Seattle, I'm Liz Jones for Weekend America.
There's a chill in the air, winter's on the way, time to dig out that warm winter coat. Unless you live in, like, San Diego or Tucson, then it's time to act all smug. For weather and fun, here's Jeannie Yandel.
Haunted forests can be fun, but you never really connect with the ghouls trying to scare you. Piggott, Arkansas wants to build trust between scarer and scaree at the friendly fairy tale forest. Chat with a witch who doesn't want to eat children and braid the big not-so-bad wolf's hair. Cloudy and 61 for the corn maze, complete with goblins. Kind, sensitive, nurturing goblins. 20 years ago, people saw mysterious lights in the sky near Milwaukee. Since then, Belleville, Wisconsin has declared itself the UFO capital of the world. In your face, Roswell. UFO Day is Belleville's 4th of July. 55 and cloudy for Flying Saucer Parade, and this being Wisconsin, beer and brats. Also, costumed pets who would rather be abducted by aliens than be forced into that ballerina costume again. Most people find huge, hairy spiders terrifying. The Tarantula Festival in Coarse Gold, California, thinks tarantulas are just misunderstood. But they're wrong. Tarantulas are terrifying. Regardless, give tarantulas a second chance at the Scream Off and Hairy Legs contest. Sunny in 88, which is the kind of weather tarantulas love. Just ignore that crawling on your leg at the food court. It's probably nothing. For more information on these and other events, go to weekendamerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm Jeannie Yandel for Weekend America.
Ben Folds is a highly skilled percussionist, but earned fame and fortune as a piano player. Those skills are not as different as you might think. Next on Weekend America.
Weekend America is supported by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about their weekends at Gather.com.
From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. Time for more fear in brief little doses. You may have heard Dana Gould on this program. He's on it a lot. Or you might know his work on The Simpsons or as a stand-up comic. But Dana's not always funny. Here is his 30-second tale of terror.
Once upon an evening dreary, late for dinner, sighing weary, my wife glared at her reflection in our mirrored closet door. "It's this babackless dress," she stuttered. "It makes my back look fat." I muttered, "No, it doesn't, hun, you're crazy," but alas, I was ignored. And so Forrest hatched a plot. Improvised there on the spot, around her waist I placed my arms and whispered gently, "Me amor." "We'll be late," she gently chided, grabbed her purse and glided down the stairs into the car for what the evening had in store. So I turned off the light and bid a fond good night to my perplexed reflection in our mirrored closet door.
Dana Gould is a comedian and writer in Hollywood. More 30-second tales of terror are at weekendamerica.org. Ben Folds is on the road this weekend. The singer, songwriter, pianist plays in Austin, Texas tonight. Folds has been touring on and off for more than 10 years. That can be a grind. So he brings toys. You should see the stage at his concerts. French horns, multiple glockenspiels, melodicas, a grand piano that he pulls from town to town. It's like an orchestra up there, but with just a few guys. I caught up with Ben Folds backstage at a recent stop here in the Twin Cities area, and I asked him about his touring arsenal.
Well, of course, there's piano, bass, and drums. That's the staple for me. And then there's, we have French horn, glockenspiel. We have triangles, shakers, tambourines, synthesizers.
And what goes into that for you as a composer? Are you working on a song and say, you know, I'm going to need glockenspiel here? When does the instrumentation come into it creatively for you?
I like to work with what I got. You know, there's two guys back there, and we had a lot of toys, so I start to find use for those. You know, and I've always thought, you know, you could do it with pots and pans or whatever.
Yeah.
Sometimes it sounds best just piano, bass, and drums, and we don't have to use our arsenal. You know.
I noticed that you have a guitar up there. Tell me about
your use. We've got two of them.
Two guitars. Tell me about the guitar.
Well, a guitar is just has to do with guitar envy. Yeah, it's a strap-on synthesizer. It wears like a guitar for a piano player that can stand up and play them.
Is the guitar there for fun, or is it there as a serious, non-ironic instrument?
Well, it's for theater. It's so that there are two positions for guys wearing massive frowny masks.
Really?
And they're sporting the guitar and two big yellow upside down smiles.
Why are they doing
for
that?
For this frown, we have a song called the Frown Song.
Oh,
and so okay. It's sort of the anthem for people who walk around town bumming people out.
Tread slowly from the car to the spa, like a weary, war-torn refugee, crossing the border with your starving child. It's a struggle just to get to Shiatsu. Present the waitress with your allergy card and tell her all of your problems and leave no tip at all.
How about the process of touring with all this stuff? It's not just you and a banjo in a case. You got a lot of stuff to take
care of. It's a rock tour. On one hand, I suppose we've been kind of minimalist over the years because I've gone either just as a piano player or we've had piano, bass, and drums. But even that, I mean, the piano's pretty big, so I can't really call myself all that portable. I felt like we were going into a time period where everyone was saying that touring is very difficult, it's very expensive, audiences are thinning out because they don't have the money to go to rock shows. So my natural knee jerk is to spend more when I know I'm going to make less. But some of that is because I feel like if people are going to get off the couch or out of work or whatever they got to do to get to a show, they should actually get a generous one. I've always enjoyed making rock music as a piano, bass, and drums act when no one else was doing that. That didn't seem like a very logical palette. But, you know, creativity, I think, is determined by how you're limited. And then your own inherent limitations, your creative limitations determine your style. Your physical limitations around you kind of determine how creative you're going to be.
you know, a lot of people think of you as a pianist, but you're a big percussionist as well. How do those intersect for you?
Well, I play piano like a left-handed drummer. And I started, my first instrument was percussion. I played a basketball before, like for 2 years before I could do it on a snare drum, before we had a snare drum. So I was always practicing patterns on a basketball with two sticks.
Because you just didn't have a drum?
We didn't have a drum, and we had a small house, and no one wanted to hear the noise. So, I mean, once a week in band class, I got to play the real snare drum, but all my practice was done on a basketball.
When you say play it like a left-handed drummer, I don't understand what that means. What does that mean?
Well, I'm lucky because I was naturally left-handed, and then I was coerced into being right-handed when we changed over to cursive. And I played guitar left-handed for a little while, and then I switched back over to right-handed. But I still play left-hand lead, which is actually snare drum patterns. If you go left, right, left, left, right, left, right, right, left, right, left, left. So everything starts with your left hand. If you're playing drums and you're playing right-handed, everything becomes right-hand lead. So it was counter. So I learned to play left-handed drums. Really good for piano because everything on my downbeat remains in my left hand then because I'm leading with my left hand. I always get big compliments on other piano players, and I'm not an amazing piano player by any stretch.
Because you're drumming.
Because I'm drumming and I'm leading with my left hand, and it's all the coordination is easy for me because I practiced all these percussion patterns when I was growing up like a fiend every day.
That's Ben Folds, and that's it for another hour of American Public Media's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. Free podcast of the entire program is at weekendamerica.org. Get out and enjoy your weekend. Bye now.
Weekend America is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul, and made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by American Public Media.
Before you conquer, you need to divide. I'm John Moe. On the next week in America, we visit the campaign of 1968, where resentment was harvested for votes.
The idea was you intentionally find fault lines that get Americans angry at each other, hating each other, and that your side of the divide will be bigger, and then you win.
It's the 40th birthday of the politics of division. Join us.